welcome to another episode of Disrupt. I'm HHCN editor Bob Holly. There's a lot of home health movement on Capitol Hill right now, and I know I sometimes have a hard time keeping up with everything. To help make sense of it all, we're talking to Bill Dombey once again for this latest episode of Disrupt. He's the president of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice, but most of you probably knew that already. In addition to emerging policies out of Washington, Bill and I chat about the home health proposed payment rule, which is likely coming out any second now, potentially even before we get this podcast out the door. We'll get to all that and more in just a second, but first, a quick word from our sponsors. Looking to build physician partnerships and increase home health referrals? How about expanding in new locations through mergers and acquisitions? Homecare Homebase helps growing agencies of all sizes streamline processes and enhance interoperability with flexible blueprints for long-term success. We'll help you attract top talent and enhance clinical care with expert tools that allow clinicians to complete required documentation in the home, not after hours. We can also tackle revenue cycle management for you, giving you more time to focus on the patients and families who need you. Grow your business with the number one industry leader. To learn more, go to hchb.com/growhomehealth. And now for the podcast episode. I am now pleased to welcome Bill Dombey, president of the National Association for Home Care and Hospice. Bill, very pleased to have you back on Disrupt.
Glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation, Bob.
So we wanted to bring you back because there have been a lot of developments on Capitol Hill, lots of discussions for how to support home health, home care, home and community-based services, everything from the infrastructure proposal to the American Rescue Plan. There's been some news at CMS. So we have a lot of stuff to dig into right now.
It is a busy summer, that's for sure.
Well, let's start with maybe the latest news. I know last week there was an announcement from HHS that had to do with the Provider Relief Fund and some reporting requirement deadlines. What's the latest with that?
Well, this has been an open issue for a number of months, and it actually has two elements to it. One is the reporting deadlines, but also is the use-by date. You know, when we go to the supermarket and we look at it's something we're buying, we often look at a use-by date. Well, the use-by date applies to the use of the provider relief funds. And there had been an effort to try to extend that date that the funds had to be used by. And HHS responded to those requests by making some modifications on that. And that then is tied to what the reporting requirements are. For home health, hospice, and other Medicare providers generally, the use-by date stays the same because they broke it up into various periods from the calendar year last year, the first period being the April through June period. That's when most home health agencies received their 6.9% of their 2019 Medicare revenues as a provider relief fund distribution in what's known as general distribution number one. The use date stays the same for those, which is at the end of the month of June. But then for the second distribution period, they also continued it towards the end of June because all those general distribution funds in number two were received before June 30th. Later funds, a number of them were received by home health agencies when they demonstrated either that they didn't get what they were entitled to or that they were looking for additional monies. And those move into the phase three distribution, which is extended in terms of a use-by date to the end of the calendar year. So depends on when you got it, and that then triggers when you need to report it. So most home health agencies, the reporting deadline will be 90 days, starting 90 days from, you know, for a period of 90 days total. So a July 1st start date is September 30th. End date for the reporting responsibilities. This may be a little more complicated for people to, you know, get in their heads listening to the podcast. So the best place to go is simply just Google HHS Provider Relief Fund, and it will take you to a very robust section of HHS website with all that information. We also have it in our newsletter from a few days ago.
And what's going on with the Provider Relief Fund overall? Have those funds been totally depleted? Should home health providers and other Medicare reimbursed organizations be expecting any new rounds of potential relief?
Last week, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Becerra, indicated by their calculation, there's approximately $25 billion still left in the provider relief fund. And the intention with those remaining funds at this point is to target them in an undesignated targeting at this point. So we are, you know, continuing to make a push that some of those monies be targeted towards home care, but we don't have word back on that so far. So I would say it's probably safe to assume that the majority of home health agencies would not be well positioned to expect any further distribution out of the provider relief fund, unless, of course, we see something change in the status of where we are with the public health emergency now. But if there was one sector of home care that might keep its eyes and ears open, it's the non-medical side of home care that is not Medicaid as well, that it's a private pay service or, you know, some other funding besides Medicare or Medicaid for it. But, you know, the kind of targeting that they would be looking at might be in rural areas. It might be when you could demonstrate a special need on a very individualized basis as compared to a general distribution approach, which we do not expect to see any more of that.
And just to clarify for listeners, when I asked that first question, I said last week. Bill and I are talking now on June 17th. We're going to be jumping around a little bit. Also, as far as recent news, earlier this week, so just a couple of days ago, I think it was maybe June 15th, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission released its June report. There wasn't a ton in there about home health care, but there were some interesting comments on alternative payment models, specifically a need to perhaps roll some models back due to redundancies. There's just too many models out there. Providers could be participating in multiple models all at one time, which could lead to confusion. Any takeaways in regard to that specific point or anything else from the MedPAC report? And while we're talking about alternative payment models, what's going on with the value-based purchasing model? Because I know we heard there was an expansion coming.
Well, let's start with that first part of the question then in terms of the alternative payment models and MedPAC's view of it. I think we share their view that it's difficult to understand what is triggering the outcomes that they're trying to measure with these alternative payment models because so many of them are in play. Now, none of them are very specific to home care, home health care, you know, but, you know, they're there with the BPCI advanced model, does some part of it. The ACOs, you know, obviously integrate home health into the mix. So it's very likely to trigger that type of evaluation at CMI that you would hope to see regarding the value of continuing demonstration programs. Liz Fowler, the now head of CMI, is a very, very experienced individual, and it wouldn't surprise me if she was already working in her team, working on the same issues before MedPAC even came out with its June report. So not any in an immediate term at time period, a real game changer. The most notable thing actually I found in the June report from MedPAC was actually on the skilled nursing facility value-based purchasing program, where MedPAC was recommending that it immediately cease and be replaced with a completely different program, one that relies upon objective measures rather than a combination of measures as the VBP programs there. I offer that because there may be a tie-in ultimately to the way CMI looks at home health value-based purchasing in its demo. The previous administration had planned on expanding it nationwide to start January 1st, 2022, but that interest got caught up in the change of administrations when regulation and regulatory actions were frozen for a period. We have had conversation with CMI about where they may go with the home health value-based purchasing program now that it's in its last year, and left with a very distinct impression that they will be expanding it as was planned under the old administration, at least in some form or fashion. Again, this comes by way of deduction rather than direct information, but our deduction is that they still will expand it nationwide, but it probably won't go on the same timetable because it's one thing to give providers notice in January 2021 that it will start in January 2022. It's another thing to give providers a notice much later than that. We're now 6 months later to where it might have otherwise come out. We have actually suggested some reforms to the value-based purchasing program, such as a shared savings approach. The program, in the 4 years of evaluation of it so far, has saved over $600 million. And the way it operates is, you know, there are winners and losers from within the home health community in, on an individual state basis. We think that an added incentive of sharing some of the savings to people from the savings the Medicare program gets will further result in the kind of outcomes that CMS and CMI would like to see. One reason we're supportive of expanding the value-based purchasing program, it has so firmly established what we've all been saying for a long time, which is that home health brings dynamic value. The $600 million in savings comes primarily from reducing hospitalizations and rehospitalizations. A great value comes from reducing the cost of a hospitalization, for sure. So we think home health has now firmly established itself as having that kind of dynamic value through value-based purchasing. But we think that value proposition of home health should be rewarded for good deeds. We don't particularly care for the fact that providers can improve their performance even on rehospitalizations and find themselves penalized because others improve their performance even to a greater degree. And yet Medicare ends up with $600 million of savings. So what we expect, you know, and again, this is our best estimate of where things will be, is the upcoming home health payment rule will include a proposal to expand the value-based purchasing program nationwide. It's anticipated that we will see that proposed rule in the last week of June or first week of July. Again, just our best guess on at that point. So I'm not sure when the podcast gets broadcasted, but if it broadcasted after that, we may already, you know, be out there providing everybody with a lot of detailed information about value-based purchasing. So we're pro home health value-based purchasing, and we think that CMS can do also some better incentives to those participants.
So you set me up perfectly for my next question, so I have to thank you for that. I was going to ask what you and what NAHC thinks is going to be included in the home health proposed payment rule for 2022. Do we really know at this point? If we don't know, you know, what would NAHC like to see?
Okay, well, we don't know. And here's what I'll tell you about why we don't know. If someone at CMS tells us what's in that proposed rule and they get caught, they not only lose their job, but they may go to jail. So this is when that cone of silence comes on CMS relative to rulemaking. They're very serious about those things. So what would we want to see in it and what would we expect to see in it? What we would want to see in it would be CMS rolling back the 4.36 behavioral adjustment that was in the 2020 payment rule and was continued in the 2021 payment rule. We believe that during 2020, the PDGM was not budget neutral, that in particular because of the high volume increase in LUPAs, but the patient census change and evidence regarding that those areas of behavioral change that were expected did not materialize. It may be a simple way of looking at it, and CMS has to go through a much more complex approach to it, but we think we'd like to see that in there. What we would expect to see probably comes by way of what we learned through the skilled nursing facility rule. CMS, in the skilled nursing facility proposed rule, said, we think that you have been overpaid with the new payment model, but we're not going to take any money back from you yet until we have a full year's worth of data at the earliest and be able to really crunch the numbers to determine whether it was budget neutral or not. So we expect CMS, even though we'd like to see a rollback of the 4.36, is more likely to simply say they're not ready yet to be able to do an evaluation on behavioral adjustment and budget neutrality. So what we then expect to see otherwise is a kind of a plain vanilla market basket index increase of payment to the providers of services and stability around PDGM, not messing at all really with the architecture of PDGM. I'll put a footnote on what else we might expect to see, and it's not related to home health, but to hospice. We expect to see the proposed home health rule will include a proposal for intermediate sanctions on survey and certification for hospice, as was mandated by end of the year legislation in 2020. So there's always a little bit of tweaking that they'll do around measures for home healthcare compare and the like, but nothing really dramatic do we expect to see. in the middle of a pandemic, you kind of appreciate predictability and stability. So I think that's going to be the rule of the day.
And as it relates to end of life care, it's also my understanding that you and your team have been promoting the inclusion of a specific palliative care coverage as part of the home health benefit. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, this is something which has long been missing from the guidelines and standards around the home health benefit, even though there are home health agencies who have successfully provided skilled palliative care under the home health benefit. So what we've done is we've taken the benefit standards that are in the manuals guidance from CMS and put in wherever appropriate, you know, either the word palliation or palliative, which we put in quite a few references to it, you know, as a skilled service. And then we added to it guidance by way of examples of skilled palliative care from nurses and therapists that could make up, you know, a qualification for the home health benefit. From a, you know, a design standpoint, it fits within the design of the home health manual. You know, this is in line with also a recognition that palliative care is very important at end of life, but palliative care is important at any point in life. And that, you know, it is a situation where you may have people getting curative services who recover, but could benefit from skilled palliative care by a home health agency, and likewise, pre-hospice or even maybe an alternative to hospice palliative care through a home health agency for those individuals who do not want to elect hospice. So if you look at the universe of palliative care in its whole sense, there is a portion of it that home health agencies do and can provide very capably. Likewise with hospice as well, but there's more to the universe than that. The prime message we're trying to send to on this is that palliative care is not limited to end-of-life palliative care. You know, palliative has much more value than that. So the game plan is to bring this forward to CMS as a regulatory type change without having to go through Congress to give home health agencies the confidence that they can take on a census of patients where the only skilled care is one which is related to palliative services, be it nursing or therapy services. So we think this is an overdue improvement in the Medicare guidance. But I can guarantee you that there will be people listening to this podcast who will not only say yay, but they'll say we've been doing it. And now this will give us the security of knowing, you know, some post-pay audit doesn't come back and, you know, somebody doing the audit is confused because palliation's not in the Medicare manual.
Yeah. And I bet there are also people that perhaps would be listening to the podcast who point out, you know, Medicare doesn't have a lot of money to work with. But my first reaction to that would be palliative care is something that really keeps people out of the hospital, very, very sick people out of the hospital. So something, you know, a more formalized palliative care offering in Medicare seems like it could really save the system money in the long run.
I fully agree with you. You know, at the same time, you know, this is a right people have to that service and they should get it. And, you know, then Medicare can deal with the budgeting aspects of it. But I mean, we don't expect the budget to bust on this. Mm-hmm. One of the benefits of going through the process that we will be going through is that it doesn't necessitate a review by the Congressional Budget Office with legislation proposed by members of Congress. You know, it fits into the home health benefit. And, you know, relative to they don't have a lot of money, yes, you know, we have a trust fund that is very weak at this point. And, you know, Congress will look at all elements of the Medicare program when looking at how to stabilize that trust fund.
Let's talk about kind of one of the biggest items in Congress right now, and that's the infrastructure bill and the back and forth between the parties on what that should look like, whether caregiving should be considered infrastructure or not. What's the latest on that? Because I also know this morning, again, June 17th, there was a Senate hearing about, you know, the value of caregiving. And I think they actually had a home care aide who said, you know, the window is now, Congress needs to act and include caregiving as part of this infrastructure bill.
Well, and it's pretty clear to us that caregiving is part of the infrastructure of our society. As much as it is important to have good roads and bridges, it's important, particularly with an aging population, to have a framework for caring for those individuals. It's clearly related to the economy. The vast majority of personal care supports provided to people in their homes come from family members, which often means the individual has to leave their job, you know, taking that productivity away from our country, and then reducing household income generally, putting them in a position of not contributing back to the economy with their own purchases and the like. So, I mean, we agree with the Biden administration that care infrastructure is as valid a part of infrastructure as bridges and roads and airports and harbors. From the perspective of where it stands in Congress on this date, the 17th of June, as you said, you know, it has not been embraced by the Republicans in Congress as part of what they want to do on the infrastructure, or the moderate Democrats, for that matter, are not wholesale on board with the $400 billion the Biden administration has proposed. Now, the most promising part of that is that the administration has said one way or another, whether it's in round one of infrastructure or otherwise, they are going to continue their efforts to get home care supported through congressional action. So, you know, whether it's the American Jobs Plan or the American Families Plan or something else, there is still a very strong interest in Congress, and I would bet among a number of Republicans, to do something about it, but perhaps through a different vehicle than the infrastructure legislation. That hearing that you mentioned, you know, indicated strong support for doing care at home, strong support for providing care to family caregivers, as well as to those caregivers that are there. But there are some other hot button issues in that effort of the administration. One of the hot button issues is it's focused seemingly mostly on Medicaid. And Medicaid is a program that first requires pauperization of individuals. They have to be poor to qualify for Medicaid. So part of the concerns that have been raised out there is, can we do better than pauperizing people before we provide them care? In addition, there is the unionization element there. President Biden has been very transparent. He's union supportive, and he's union supportive in home care. You know, is that something that needs to be done to build up the care infrastructure, or are there other ways to take care of those hardworking caregivers who really do deserve not just more respect from people, but they deserve better compensation than Medicaid programs currently allow? That's a message we've sent to the administration, is that we're supportive of the care infrastructure proposals, but the administration has to recognize that the largest employer of healthcare givers that are paid very low wages, you know, employer with quotes around it, is Medicaid, which is a federal state program. You can't pay somebody a living wage if you're getting $12 an hour from your state Medicaid program for those services. So the most promising part, though, is we're in the dialogue on this. We're at the table relative to that dialogue, and we're in a dialogue enough that President Biden, for the first time in my lifetime, was a president in a joint session of Congress referencing healthcare from the home as a complete priority for his administration. We've had other presidents of both parties who've been strongly supporting home care, but in a joint session of Congress to talk about home care, that's a pretty good place to be going forward.
And this is a total anecdote, but I think it supports what you're talking about. On LinkedIn, of all places, I've actually been getting alerts that some of the people viewing my LinkedIn profile are congressional staffers. And I think that, you know, shows that you have these staffers who are trying to learn as much as they can about home health and home care and how to care for an aging population.
Well, smart people are the people they generally get as staffers, and that's a smart thing that they're doing.
I know another separate thing related to aging in place and keeping people at home, out of the hospital, out of facilities, is something called the Choose Home model. That's something that I think LHC Group, for example, has talked about during earnings calls in the past. I know that they've shouted out your advocacy as well, some of the other organizations out there. What's the status of Choose Home? And what's the likelihood that maybe there's movement on that this year or even next?
Well, if the wishes that I pray for every morning and night happen, we'll see the Choose Home legislation introduced before the July 4th congressional recess. My prayers weren't answered last year when I'd hoped they'd be done before the end of the year recess, but we have a legislative draft that came from the Senate Legislative Council in hand. It has gone through many iterations. We've garnered significant support from both houses of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats. We think we've lined up the sponsors of the legislation. We're waiting to hear from a couple of stakeholders that might make a difference on who comes on board with it. But that's the pathway we see for it now is introduction, probably an even chance of it at least before the July 4th recess, which means just a matter of days from now. But if not then, you know, we'll see it happen before the Labor Day recess. We're firmly convinced this has legs to it. This has traction to it. The level of enthusiasm we've seen from congressional offices, and not just staff people, but from the member of Congress himself and herself. We've talked to 36 members of Congress at least so far directly about that. You know, what it does is it provides an alternative to the Medicare skilled nursing facility benefit at home. You know, I won't get into the details. It would take too long to do so, but it provides a viable option for many of the people who otherwise would go from hospital into a skilled nursing facility, sometimes never coming out again, you know, but giving them a quicker bridge to healthcare at home. We think, you know, is something that has been proven to be clinically viable during the pandemic and before. Hospital at home obviously shows it's clinically viable. So nursing home at home should be as well, but also viable in so many other ways as Medicaid programs for a different population of nursing home patients have long been doing this quite successfully, saving Medicaid money and really taking care of millions of people on an annual basis who otherwise would have gone into an institutional care setting. So anybody listening into this podcast, you know, you can go to our website, get more information about it. But most importantly, once it is introduced, we'll be asking for you all to be getting on that train of grassroots support. Noise matters in Washington. And this is one where I think you will find a very receptive audience when you ask them to co-sponsor that legislation once it's introduced.
We've talked about Choose Home. We've talked about the infrastructure bill. We've talked about what to expect maybe in the upcoming home health proposed payment rule. And we also talked about the MedPAC report that recently came out, plus provider relief funds news. Covered a lot of ground already. Apart from all that, what else is on NAC's radar? What's kind of got your attention at the moment?
Well, you know, from a legislative and policy standpoint, we think it's time to pass the legislation, which is both in the House and the Senate, that would authorize the Medicare program to pay for telehealth services in the home setting by home health agencies. And that is, you know, a rerun of last year's legislation that was introduced at the end of the year. It's Senate Bill 1309 and House Bill H.R. 3371, otherwise known as the HEAT Act. So that is a priority without a doubt. We also believe a priority should be the reinstatement, but with some reforms of the rural add-on under the Medicare home health benefit, which is essentially phased out at this stage or near phasing out completely. In our conversations, you know, on the Hill, we know it needs to be targeted. There are some rural locations and rural home health agencies financially. We can't say support the need for added reimbursement to them, but there are many, many, many more that can. Rural is a broad standard. It takes into account very, very, very wide breadth of rural services. There's a difference between a rural Maryland location and an Oklahoma rural location and a Washington State rural location. And even within those states, there's distinctions in terms of cost of care. So rural add-on and telehealth reimbursement are very much two of the items that we have in addition to what we've already expressed. The other area which we think crosses all aspects of care in the home is workforce related, actually. This is a special time for healthcare at home, you know, with the opportunities that are rising and the challenges that are there are primarily around workforce. You know, whether it's home health or hospice or home infusion therapy or private duty, non-medical home care, everything, you know, we've got workforce issues, nurses and home care aides in particular. We think the country needs a commitment in so many ways to a multidimensional workforce support effort to address what we know is happening already. You know, baby boomers are reaching that age of 75, which seems to be the age when people start having a greater need for healthcare supports, in particular in the home care setting. We need the workforce to make that happen. So, you know, like I said, multidimensional, everything from issues of compensation and education to immigration and even image issues regarding the respect for that workforce. So, you know, we are, you know, having discussions, convening a number of stakeholders into those discussions to come up with that kind of four corners plan, multidimensional, to deal with these issues and to deal with them in ways that don't just simply take the workforce from one sector of healthcare and move it to another, but expands the workforce itself.
We've been talking for this podcast for about 30 minutes. And I think for me personally, it's been a record to go 30 minutes during any kind of interview or podcast discussion without uttering the word COVID or the coronavirus. But I think I'm going to break that record here to ask how things are going in terms of home care staff vaccinations for COVID.
You know, it's a mixed bag, Bob. It really is. You know, the board of directors for NAC meets every 2 weeks for one purpose, and that's to get as up to date as they can on everything COVID. And of most recent time, you know, we've been focused on vaccinations of the homebound, but even more so on staff vaccinations. And, you know, the reports we get from a very diverse board that we have, you know, are such that in some instances, 90%+ of the staff is vaccinated. And in other instances, it's barely over 50%. Common thread, home care aides tend to be less vaccinated than the professional staff or nurses and therapists. But even in the nurses and therapists realm, we have one board member who heads up their organization who is a therapist, and she's got 90% of her therapists vaccinated and just barely over 50% of the nurses vaccinated among staff. And another one is headed up by a nurse, and she has the reverse. 90% of the nurses are vaccinated and 50% of the therapists are vaccinated. That may tell us there's a peer-to-peer kind of a connection that's there on it. But, you know, we have done a lot of work around staff hesitancy in getting vaccinated, and we are continuing to work directly with the CDC in an effort around that, and we're going to be continuing to step it up even further. I think one of the things which is going to be considered, and it's already happened in some health systems, is mandating vaccinations. And you're probably familiar, again, this is the 17th of June, but just the other day, the lawsuit against Houston Methodist Hospital was won by the hospital relative to their mandated requirements for vaccinations. So I think you may see some more there. This is an issue which, you know, is about public safety, patient safety, and the like. And, you know, what the people in Houston said, and, you know, home care companies are going to have to take their own approaches on it. People in Houston said was, you know, you want to work for us, you have to get vaccinated. If you don't want to work for us, you don't want to be vaccinated, go find a job somewhere else. That's how serious this has gotten. And, you know, while you want to respect individuals, you know, personal choices that they make, this is not simply about personal choice for that individual. This is not only about infecting you yourself. This is about, you know, the effect it has on patients, the patients' family members, and colleagues as well. So we think that home healthcare has done a pretty good job in dealing with it. There's a commitment to do more. The NAC board of directors early on, you know, unanimously agreed to a resolution that they would be vaccinated. And that is where all the board is at this point in time. So, yes, does this sound like pro-vaccination from NAC? We are pro-vaccination.
Well, I think that checks off a lot of the questions I had going into this conversation. One thing I was curious about, have you or has NAC been able to meet with the new CMS administrator yet? Do we know anything about her or what to expect?
I mean, we know a lot about her. We have not met with her yet. Our understanding is she's not met with many people yet. She's still trying to, you know, get her feet on the ground. She comes by way of a solid health background. It included working on the Subcommittee of Health for the Ways and Means Committee. So we did not interact with her when she was over there as a congressional staffer because her portfolio did not include home health or hospice within Ways and Means. Her reputation is one of very solid. She is surrounding herself with some very fine lieutenants who are probably better off called colonels rather than lieutenants. Liz Fowler heading up the innovations branch, for example. John Blum coming back from the Obama administration to be her prime deputy administrator. These are people we know well, have high respect for, and know they have high respect for healthcare at home. So we think there's a good team there on it, that affects home health, hospice, and anything else, Medicare or Medicaid. So we're going to pick our spots, though, when we try to take the administrator's time. It's going to have to be important enough. But we think through our access to career staff, as well as to the, to the team she's brought around her, we have a good place to be right now, and think, the administration is going to be pro-home care. They have to kind of reflect where the president is, and the president is certainly pro-home care.
Yep. Well, Bill, it has been a pleasure catching up. I think over the past, 16 months or so, we've had a lot of phone conversations, done a couple of podcasts, but it's been a while since we sat down in the same room and chatted. Hopefully that changes this year. I know in just a month or a couple months that you'll actually be in my neck of the woods in Chicago for FMC 2021. Hopefully we could say hi then.
Well, I definitely want to see you there face-to-face at FMC. It is our return to an in-person conference, FMC being our financial management conference. Just one little bit of information about it. We're also offering a virtual option for people. It won't be live virtual, but the registrations that we're getting for the conference are about 80% of the registrants are coming for in-person. So I think there's been some comfort zone that has been created about that, maybe some pent-up demand for being able to network with individuals. But for anyone who's ever attended our financial management conference, they know the takeaways are of high value there. This is essentially a conference put together by C-suite people from CFOs and COOs and CEOs. So it really fits, with what people themselves believe to be important rather than what somebody else might think is important for them. So again, Bob, if you're there, and I expect you will be there, let's tap elbows or fists and, let's get reconnected. And same for anybody from listening in the podcast, it'll be the first week of August. It'll be in downtown Chicago. And Illinois has now completely reopened.
That is true. It's been an interesting experience here in Chicago. And as a White Sox fan, I'm excited to go to Guaranteed Rate with 100% capacity in the not too distant future.
Well, I do understand the White Sox are playing at the at some point near around a financial management conference. And I'm a baseball fan as well with you. And the best game that could have been for that conference would be the White Sox against the Yankees, because I'm a Yankee fan. No offense to the White Sox, who have the best record in baseball on this day, and the Yankees don't.
Well, Bill, it was really a joy to catch up. Thank you so much for coming on Disrupt. Hopefully see you soon.
See you then. Take care, everybody. Appreciate all your time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Disrupt. For more news and insights on the home health, home care, and hospice industries, subscribe to our daily or weekly newsletters at homehealthcarenews.com. I'm Robert Holly, and this has been a production of Aging Media Network, Chicago, Illinois.